what I'm hearing when they talk about that is focusing on the child's behavior and not the academics, being pushed through if you're not a problem student, and then the teachers not being aware.
I think there's these issues around the way that some of these grassroots organizations are sort of structured from the beginning, why they have challenges connecting with us is because they're not having us and our voices in the beginning.
I'm really struck by how old people are before they're being diagnosed.
Yes.
There is no early diagnosis happening here.
When young Black male students are paired with Black teachers, there is a material difference in the amount of diagnosis of special education.
What would happen if our HBCUs were preparing the most equipped diagnostic and prescriptive teachers in the country?
Hello, and welcome to the Black and Dyslexic Podcast with Winifred A. Winston and LaDerek Horn, the show that unapologetically focuses on helping Black and underrepresented minorities navigate the special education process. We want to help raise awareness in the Black and brown community, remove the stigma about learning disabilities, and provide you access to professionals in the space of dyslexia and special education that you need to hear from.
Today's episode is proudly sponsored by the Lab School of Washington, D.C. At the Lab School, they understand that every child learns differently. That's why they are dedicated to providing personalized education for students with learning differences, including dyslexia. With specialized programs tailored to individual needs, their experienced educators empower students to unlock their full potential and thrive academically, socially, and beyond. Discover a nurturing environment where every child is celebrated for their unique strengths. To learn more about Lab School, go to labschool.org. That's labschool.org.
So now we have a wonderful treat for you all. We have LaDerek Horn right here, who is a friend of Omaha.
That's right.
He's been here a number of times. And LaDerek Horn is a renowned poet, speaker, and author. He has devoted his life to championing the rights of individuals with disabilities. Having navigated his own learning disability since the third grade, LaDerek seamlessly weaves dynamic spoken word poetry into his advocacy, igniting discussions on equal opportunity, pride, and self-determination. His poetic gift serves as a powerful catalyst for fostering hope within the disability community, positioning him as a compelling advocate and speaker. LaDerek's influence extends far and wide, from conducting impactful workshops to delivering keynote speeches and delivering captivating performances at prestigious venues such as the White House and the United Nations. His work unifies efforts across diverse disability challenges, working towards system change. So welcome LaDerek Horn back to Omaha, Nebraska, my brother, my friend. Then we have the wonderful Ms. Winifred Winston, and she is the co-host and founder of Black and Dyslexic Podcast. And she has worked in education providing career management services for more than 15 years in K through 12 and higher education as a high school teacher, career consultant, and adjunct instructor. After working for public school districts, serving as an administrator of a special education school, and going through the special education process with her daughter, Winifred quickly realized Black and underrepresented minorities lacked accurate information about dyslexia interventions and instructional strategies. Not wanting another parent to experience the challenges she faced, Winifred founded Dyslexia Advocation, a 501c3 charitable organization to provide adults and parents of struggling readers access to quality, affordable remediation and access to a network of literacy and special education subject matter experts. In addition, she is the host, as I have said, of the Black and Dyslexic Podcast with LaDerek Horn. Give them a round of applause. Then we have four phenomenal panelists, and they all have something in common. Either they are experiencing dyslexia because they are the parent or grandparent of someone that is dyslexic, and they are an advocate and powerful in their position in doing that, or they are a teacher and a dean who also see this every day. As the Dean of Students, Mr. Jerry Samuels from the Phoenix Academy, he's with us today, wave your hand. Ms. Sheila Carr from Washington, D.C., the co-founder of Decoding Dyslexia D.C. She is a grandmother, and I say a champion. She's a mother, and she loves her grandchildren, and they have dyslexia, some of them do, and she is just powerful. If you see her, tag her on Facebook. She's a wealth of information, and she is very proud of who she is and her culture. Then we have Shay Page, a good friend of mine who is a dyslexic. She is a Christian counselor. She just got her master's in psychology and dyslexic, okay? And then we have the beautiful Miss Lincoln Teen, Janae Harris. So I'll hand it over. And they're on live, too.
All right. It is. Okay. I jumped off the stage and turned it on, so it should be all right. All right, how's everybody doing? All right, so this is the Black and Dyslexic Podcast. We usually do this on Zoom at home and record them. We've only done this live in front of an audience one time, but I am like very, very grateful to be here and to have the opportunity to interact with this amazing panel. So I think maybe just to get us started, I'm gonna pass the mic to Winifred. Just show, actually clap it up. Has anyone ever listened to the Black and Dyslexic Podcast? All right, so not everybody. So I'm going to ask Winifred just to kind of give a little bit of background about the show and the idea to get it started. I'm the co-host, but this was her brainchild. So if you can just kind of start there, and then we'll go to our panelists after that. So Winifred.
Yep. Hello, everyone. I'm so excited that we're able to do this live and in person. Earlier when you heard Clarice talking about in 2020, she was inspired to start Black Literacy Matters. That's where Black and Dyslexic came to fruition as well. I had an experience that kind of opened my eyes. I tell this on the podcast and I share the story that I went to a predominantly white university for undergrad and graduate. Two of my first jobs out of college, I was the only Black person. So I've always been the only Black person in white spaces. When I started advocating and Black parents would come up to me and tell me that they felt uncomfortable or someone said something inappropriate. Oh no, no, they want to help your child learn to read. And then George Floyd was murdered and it just slapped me in my face that I was wrong. Because I had been in white spaces and had been the only Black person, I was complicit. Sometimes I ignored some things. Sometimes I overlooked them because that's just how I navigated in the space. And so as I navigated and came to this realization, like, you need to use your privilege. You're on boards, you're on committees, you need to be a voice, but you also need a platform so others can share their voices. I would have parents come to the private dyslexia school and not get out of their car, right? And not get out of their car. And I'm like, oh no, they want to help, get out of your car. And just being a little naive. Yeah, being a little naive. And so I started the Black and Dyslexic Podcast because I wanted to remove the stigma in the Black and brown community about learning disabilities. I wanted to raise awareness, but more importantly, I wanted Black and brown parents to have access to the professionals that I now had access to, that were in my circle, that I could call upon and say, hey, can you look over this evaluation for me? Or hey, I have this IEP meeting come up. What should I say here? Because when I started this journey, I did not have that. And I did training, I changed careers, I became director of admissions of a special education school because I wanted to know why there weren't more Black parents in the schools and why did it seem like there was a system that I didn't know how to navigate. And so I started the podcast because Clarice, let me tell this part, she dug into me and was like, you've been doing this hashtag, Black and Dyslexic. And I initially started featuring athletes on Instagram. And I said, well, everybody can't identify with an athlete. So then I started doing the hashtag Black celebrities. And I said, well, everybody's not a celebrity. So then I started doing everyday dyslexics. And then folks that I knew that I was friends with, oh yeah, Winifred, I have dyslexia. I'm like, what? I've been at so many Christmas functions with you, I never knew this. And so children started reaching out to me. Oh, I didn't know Usher Raymond was dyslexic. you know, oh, I didn't know this person, Kobe Bryant, was dyslexic, you know? And so Clarice and I were talking and I was discouraged. I was like, this is hard, I'm frustrated. You know, they treated me bad. And anybody here know Clarice? She don't back down. She was like, you know what? That's you, you've been doing that. You started that, people know you from that. Get some funding, wrap it up in a program, and I don't know, do a podcast. And I thought about it. I was like, well, I am tired of writing up all these bios. And I'm like, well, if I do a podcast, I could interview them and they could tell their own story. And I said, well, let me see how I can get some funding. And then one of my board members said, well, you can't do it alone. You're doing everything alone and you can't do it by yourself. Why don't you reach out to LaDerek? I was like, he's a poet, he's a speaker. Oh, you know what? And that's how the Black and Dyslexic podcast was born. So now we're just gonna let the panelists introduce themselves.
Yeah, Clarice, you kind of jumped the gun and went through and told everybody's bio. But we're gonna ask everybody if you can just do it again. And so we can just start with you, Gregory. If you can just give your name, and if you can tell us about yourself and how you're connected to literacy and dyslexia. So just in your own words, just talk a little bit about who you are.
My name is Jerry Samuels. So I am a part of the administrative team at Phoenix Academy. It's a private intervention school here in Central Omaha. It's been around for a little over 30 years. And I've taught there, and now I'm in a leadership capacity. Working with learning disabilities and dyslexia is something that I've been, you know, entrenched in daily. Just learning disabilities in general are things that can impede the learning process are not new to me. I have ADHD. I have two children of mine that have ADHD. And I have a son of mine that's on the autism spectrum. So homework time is always very interesting. Homework time is very interesting, actually. But the reason why I really am excited about doing this podcast episode and what my, I guess, kind of my daily pursuits is I'm looking for ways to be able to help these students win. There's a local pastor here, Myron Pierce, some of you might know his name, but I remember something where he said, we can all win. And I said, absolutely, we can all win. But so many of these kids, they grew up feeling like winning is only for certain people with certain predispositions. And I really wanted to kind of break that, help them unlearn that, and help, you know, build them back up so they can be their best selves.
Hello, everyone. Oh, okay. My name is Sheila Carson Carr. I'm from Washington, D.C. And, you know, I'm just sitting here thinking, what I'm saying? Okay, I'm going to make it real fast. I didn't find out that I had dyslexia until I was 40. And I worked for the Developmental Disability State Planning Council at the time. And was doing something with my daughter, and I was like, that's me. So, long story short, the Lord put me on a mission in 18 to make sure that all DC children learn to read. So I'm sure in other questions, I'll tell you more of my story, but that's what I'm here. I'm here to make sure that we understand, like Ms. Washington said, that what we say isn't wrong, you're just not understanding how we're saying it. And our kids, if you give them that respect, they can learn, they can read, they can comprehend, and I'm here today to make sure that we can get that done.
Awesome. I am Shay Page, friend of Clarice, probably over 30 years or so. I didn't really know I was dyslexic, the word dyslexic, until I really started following her and her mission that the Lord gave her. But I had a kindergarten, basically, reading at the age of 17. And the way I learned how to read, it was started reading the Bible. And from there, getting my GED and so on, and now my master's. And so, when I tell you, hearing Dr. Washington, I could relate to everything she was saying. And so that is me just in a nutshell. I'm excited about being on the panel and answering the questions that are coming.
Hi, I'm Janae. I'm also Miss Lincoln's teen, 2024, and I have dyslexia. I'm a junior at Millard North High School and was diagnosed in third grade. It was definitely a big change for me, but was easy with how much support I had with the resources from my family and friends and just everybody around me. And becoming Miss Lincoln's teen has been such a blessing because I've been able to meet Carice, and coming to conferences like this has really taught me so much about how I relate and embrace dyslexia and how it makes me so much stronger and how I can just build up higher and higher from it. I'm going into the STEM field and hope to be an engineer, going into architecture and interior design.
All right. So Winifred's going to ask the next question. I just want to give us an overview of just what we're going to be doing over the course of our time up here. So we've got prepared questions. We're going to go through those. That'll help us to really get a sense about who's up here. And then we're going to turn it over to a Q&A. So if anyone sparks any sort of questions, write them down, take a note, and then we'll save time towards the end for the Q&A. Also, we're going to be relaxed up here, all right? I know we only got one mic for y'all and one mic for us, all right? But if someone should say something and you want to jump in and add on to it, feel free, just put your hand out and we'll pass a mic, all right?
Yep, and for those who've listened to the podcast, we normally have it very conversational, and we actually don't even use canned questions. And we just let the conversation flow. I noticed that we've got two folks up here that did not realize that they had dyslexia until they were adults. Janae, you were identified in third grade. When did you learn you were ADHD? Oh, yeah, so we're all in the same boat, basically. So just from your lens and your experience and what you know now, what do you feel like was fair or unfair and how you did not learn to read or was not given strategies to help you, right? Because now you know, hey, I'm dyslexic or now I have ADHD. I didn't find out until my daughter was identified. 40-plus-year-old walking around, classic. Is Dr. Washington in here? She told me within 5 minutes of meeting me, Winifred, I could have told you you were ADHD. Yeah, she said that on the podcast too, so it's out there. So just share with us, each of you, if you will, what you feel like had been fair or not fair in your experience and then later finding out.
For me, it was, I was kind of talking about this with one of the audience members. It's, you know, if you're dyslexic, you know, you're dumb. If you have ADHD, you're bad. So I was bad. Almost every year from about second grade on through my elementary school career, I grew up on military bases. So in that school system, they had what was called TAG, Talented and Gifted. And I was always wanting to be nominated for that by my teachers. Man, Talented and Gifted, he should go do that. And then after a while, that recommendation would fade because, well, he doesn't attend, so he doesn't complete his work. He doesn't complete his work. He doesn't do the things that he's supposed to do, right? So he doesn't conform to the model, so therefore it's like we cannot offer him this opportunity to extend his learning. So the thing that I'd find very interesting is the fact that no one decided to question that. That's what I find interesting. Like, why not say, if you see that there's something very clear that can be cultivated in a young person, try to find a way to cultivate that. Why would you just go, oh, well, you know, hey, according to the black and white rule book here, I guess I got to keep you here, buddy. So you just keep working on that worksheet. You know, it's mind-boggling to me. It's just, I don't know. I just thought more people would have a kind of take those professional risks and say, you know, maybe I need to push this kid forward.
Okay, but if you grown and in charge of the school now, so if you were going to take a leap, right? If you were going to take a leap and say, why didn't they push? What would you say? Why do you think they didn't push?
Why didn't they push? Because they were afraid of being wrong.
Mm. Okay, what do you mean? Go a little deeper for me.
Well, you know, if you go out of your way to try to say that you're not going to conform to the expectations, right, and that doesn't work out for you, that kind of ends up being an egg on your face where, hey, that kid was a complete bust. He's dumber than a rock. Like, what are you talking about, right? You know, then you get your professional judgment questioned from that point on. You know, it's almost kind of like trust. You know, you can take a long time to build trust, but it takes one moment of a lack of integrity or some sort of rift in that, and people are going to question it from then on.
And just to piggyback on what he said, it also comes with knowledge. Most of the teachers don't know what they see right now. They do not know what they're seeing. So how about our children supposed to get help? That's what I'm fighting for in D.C. right now. Train the teachers. They know these universities are not training the teachers about reading, the science of reading. And you want the teachers now that we had, because now we got the law, I told you, 23-191, the dyslexia struggling reading law in D.C. So when they take these tests and screening from K to second grade, and they identify who's left to ratify the problem? The non-trained teachers. What? What? So let me go back to what you asked. My disability is spelling. My dyslexia is spelling. And I'm just going to just say it like I always say it. The Lord always puts somebody beside me who could spell. I could speak, up here, but my spelling was, it's not far enough down there that would go. So how should somebody have helped me back then? You know, saying, well, surely your speech and your writing doesn't match. Here's some help. They didn't know.
Well, gosh, I was just sitting here thinking as they were talking, I'm coming from the aspect of the student being just pushed from school, from class to class, and not really getting the teaching or learning that I was dyslexic. And then, like you said, the teachers need to know, but also from the aspect of the poverty lifestyle that I grew up in. Just to be transparent a little bit, my mother at the time, she was a drug addict. So coming from that aspect of life, and then you just go to school and you're just there to get the lunch because there's no food at home. So school and reading, it just was nothing for me at that time because I didn't understand it. And the educators, they didn't take the time, like you said, to figure it out. Why is this child not wanting to learn? And we're just pushing them through. And I'm just here because I want to eat, because there's nothing at home. And nobody took the time to find out, well, what's going on at home. And so I went through that for years. And then I ended up getting out of school and getting my GED. And that was a challenge by itself, because I was yet trying to comprehend what I was reading, comprehend the language, what was on the paper. And so I did get that. And but what I would say is that this type of setting is so perfect for our people, for our culture, to not only just understand why a child is where they're at, but understand the dynamics of the household too, because a lot of the parents don't know how to read. And that was the problem. My mother only had like a sixth grade level education. And then her mother died when she was young. So then that took her into the life of streets. And that's what she knew. She knew the street life. She knew the hustle. And that's what she gave me, you know, until I was taken out of the home.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing when they talk about that is behavior, focusing on the child's behavior and not the academics, right? Being pushed through if you're not a problem student. And then the teachers not being aware. Even with my own ADHD, I was always in honors classes. Sometimes I was a class clown. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, so there was a lot of activity, but I still did my work, right? I would cut school, I did often, but I'd be riding the train doing my work. So I was like an AB student, and I wasn't disruptive, I wasn't a fighter, but in hindsight, I was all over the place. Right. And when I would take standardized tests, I would bomb, and I literally would be bored thinking of something totally different on a whole nother thing and come back and be like, oh yeah, the answer is so-and-so. And then it didn't really get affect me until college, because now that executive function and now the demands of the workload. So we're seeing that if you're not a problem, if you're not the class clown, we're not going to dig deeper. Right? And if you're not a problem student, or I'm just going to dismiss you because of your background, right? And it's one of those things that we don't like to talk about. Another reason for the platform. All I knew about ADHD, I grew up in the crack epidemic in Brooklyn, New York. Yeah. And that's what I knew. Right. That's all I knew. When they first diagnosed my daughter, I was like, she's a black girl. It's medical coding, insurance will pay for it. She don't have ADHD. You know what I said? Her birthday's 5 days after me. She's just like me. She got energy like me. I'm ADHD. Right? So that's what we're hearing, a common theme about the lack of education and knowledge, but then just not culturally. Culturally, we don't accept the learning disabilities, right? I don't want to be ADHD. You're not going to label my child. We're not thinking there's something else. We know that they're smart. We all say that, but we're not going to add that label.
We sort of phrased the question for adults, but Janae, you're here too, and I know you, both you and I learned that I had a learning disability when I was in the third grade. So just how do some of those challenges show up from then, you know, now that you're in high school? I'm sorry, you're so glamorous too, like this high school student. Like I knew, you know, you, like someone in the pageant, I didn't think he was gonna show up with the crown and the sash. showed up like all the way, but just, From third grade on now, just how are some of the challenges that you've had with reading and writing and dyslexia, like how's it shown up in your life?
So when I was also diagnosed with dyslexia, we also found out that I did have ADHD. Mm. So the first step of that was, okay, how can we help one to help the other? And it was definitely getting me on the right medication, and it has really helped. It's not something that I want to lean towards as I get older because I want to learn the habits to get out of it. But as I've gotten older and the reading steps that we've taken, I had a principal and my mom. They were really close, and it's really amazing to have a talkative family around you because she always wants to get involved with all the things at school and everything, which is definitely amazing. But she really had a talk with her, and they created a program for me and other students like me because it was coming up, but it wasn't very prevalent or common, and it wasn't recognized as much. So I was taking classes starting from the bottom up, and by the time I got to middle school and in seventh grade, I was reading at my correct level, and when I started, I was three grade levels below. So just the programs and the connections that I had from my parents and just the teachers around me and the school system was the most helpful thing possible for me.
All right. Well, awesome.
I want to add, she said it and I heard the audience kind of like, when she said medication, let's talk about it, yes. Right? let's talk about it. In the Black community, we don't want to use medication. My daughter is dyslexic and ADHD. And we started doing intensive interventions in second grade. My baby was doing 10 hours a week, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6. And they said, let's do medication. And I have a brother in my family who is schizophrenic who did not take his medication and he committed a crime. So in my mind, I'm like, oh no, medicine don't work. You know, he was supposed to take medicine, we just not doing medicine. And the doctor came back, we have a developmental pediatrician, and she said, well, she's doing all this tutoring and you want her to retain the strategy, she's ADHD, you should do the medicine. Mm-hmm. No, you want to put my baby on that medicine, you just want her on that medicine like a zombie. So I took the pills a couple of days. I was like, I don't know how this is making me feel, right? So I said, I did. I was at work and I was like, this is not it. Because I thought, I'm not giving her this unless I take it.
You the guinea pig?
I did. So then I thought, okay, I'm just not doing it. I still just did not feel comfortable. I just couldn't, right? So then now we're getting up on fourth grade because at first my focus is dyslexia. How is she going to learn to read? And I'm really not sold on the ADHD because I'm like, no, it's just, she's a Black girl. They just, Black kids, they want to label them ADHD. But then when the doctor said, I diagnosed you 10 years ago with ADHD, I was like, I did not hear that. I didn't hear that. I tell this story all the time. The doctor said, I gave you medicine. I said, well, I thought it was just a hookup. She said, what hookup? I said, whatever the doctors and lawyers take in school. She says, well, Winifred, no, you clearly were ADHD. And now I'm starting to see myself. Yeah, y'all laughing. Y'all could tell. Here it is on display, on live. And now I'm like, okay, we're at a private dyslexia school now because I had to pull her out of public school. She's learning to read, but things just seem slow. I'm like, we did all this intensive tutoring. You know, she's at this private dyslexia school, and I know from being an educator what we're doing from K to 3 and then 4 and up, how it changes. And I say, okay, let me try this. And I put her on medication, and the first one didn't work out. So the second one worked out well, and I saw her skyrocket. And it wasn't that the medication fixed anything with dyslexia, but now she's able to focus. She's able to retain the strategies. And I understand now that my baby's processing speed is slow. She needed repetition and different things, but I had to, as an advocate, as someone in the space, I still initially did not feel comfortable with medication. And to this day, I haven't gotten mine right. But for her, we did it. And she even now knows I'm on medication for ADHD. She says, Mommy, let me try to go to school and not use the medicine. This is what she said. She went, and I kept thinking the whole day, oh, how did she do? How did she do? She came home. She said, Mommy, it was a lot of work. She said, I told myself, Logan, you can do this. Focus. She said, I spent all day focusing on trying to focus. And she said, let's just do Monday through Friday. Right? But I just wanted to put that out there because she, bless her heart, she said it. And everybody kind of gasped. But that's one thing we don't talk about in the community. Did you have to pass it down?
I'm a huge proponent for medication, right? And having to have been diagnosed as an adult and all that, I feel like all the experiences I went through helped to prepare me for my journey in education. Like, all this was really purposeful. Working in corporate America, working in finance, doing all these sedentary jobs where you're just kind of sitting there, you're coding, or you're answering emails and all this stuff. I remember when I took medication, and I found one that worked. First of all, I had a great doctor. You can't really discount having a really great doctor that's going to really hold themselves to a high professional standard to say, we're going to keep trying, we're going to look for the right agent that's going to work for you. When I felt what focus felt like, uninhibited, I said, this is incredible. Right. If this is what people have been doing throughout my entire school career when they say, hey, it's time to work, and this is what turns on in their brain, and they just do it, you don't feel like you're having to, like, deadlift 700 pounds and then write on your worksheet at the same time. It is phenomenal, and it changed my outlook on everything. The best analogy I can give when I'm trying to talk to parents or I'm talking to other people about, like, why medicine is something they should really strongly consider is some of us in here are old enough to have used a computer with, like, Windows 97, right? Windows 99. So if you're working in an office environment and, you know, maybe you're in Word and you got this thing open and then you open up Excel. Like, Excel was kind of a dangerous program to open because it sucked up so much memory. You know, she's laughing right now. She already knows where I'm going with this, right? And if you have too many programs opening and operating at the same time, it sucks up what they call, like, the RAM, all the random active memory, how fast a computer can work and think. And I knew if I had too many things going on at the same time, I'd type one thing, it'll take forever to process. Change one cell, it'll take forever to process. This computer is spending so much of its time, my fans going, you know, and I'm like, this thing's about to go to the blue screen of death. We all know the Windows blue screen of death. And it's just going to lock up. It's not going to know what to do because it can't sit here and think about all these different things to do at the same time. That's what ADHD is like, okay? So if you can give them a medication, if you can remove that roadblock for your kids and say, you know what, I want to get you some help, you remove that huge concrete roadblock that's in their way, and then you say, now try to navigate this course, it is infinitely easier for them to be able to do that, because the one thing that they'd have to spend all their precious time, all their RAM trying to do is to say, just don't look like you're not focusing. Now you're saying, now open up another one, open up Excel, and then work on this spreadsheet, this worksheet. It's death, man. It's a blue screen of death every time, you know, and it just kills them.
As a poet, that metaphor, the way he pushed that, yo, that was awesome. Absolutely, absolutely. And you're making me question right now whether I need to try some medication myself.
I will say this, though. So I do not take medication. I haven't taken medication for a number of years. And the reason why is because I found a pursuit, and I feel like this is really my calling to be in education. And I'm like, man, I can just walk around the whole day. I just do laps in my classroom. I can sit there and talk and talk and talk, and I'm supposed to. you know? And I'm like, I have to juggle five things at the same time. I guess do a little this there. And I feel like education really has, as far as my degree of, you know, attention deficit and all that, it is really like, I just really feel like it fits me very well, this profession does. And, you know, when I worked in finance and when I was doing cubicle work and all that, that was, if I didn't take my medicine that day, I'm like, oh, crap, you know. I didn't know what the day was going to hold, but it was like, I might get some work done, you know.
I just also want to say, being a junior in high school, this is definitely the hardest year so far. I hear it from all of my friends. And being a teenage girl, growing up with ADHD and dyslexia, is very stressful. And I will admit, I am a very emotional person. I cry all the time, and I get super stressed out. But the ADHD medicine, it's not also just something that helps you just sit there and focus. It helps you and teaches your body to really be able to sit and collect itself, focus on one thing at a time, instead of being so scatterbrained and stressed out and having to deal with a bunch of emotions and taking a bunch of hard tests in school. So that's also a big thing.
The other thing that's really important is start them young. Start them young, because it wasn't for my daughter was high school by the time I found out she had ADHD. And the doctor said, well, you would get a headache if you take the medicine. You know what happened. She got a headache. So she refuses the medicine. My grandson was in middle school, and I made him take the pill every day before he got out the car. But as soon as he got older enough, it was a no-go, because people talk bad about medicine, especially in the African-American community. So if the doctor tells you at a young age, please start at a young age, because that crazy middle school year and the high school year, their brain ain't having it. They're not having it. They're going to fight you on it. So just start young.
Yeah, and the last thing I want to say about that is educate yourself and educate your child. It's right. Not enough to just give them the medicine. We see a developmental pediatrician to monitor the ADHD, right. And we have a regular pediatrician. My daughter is 14. She knew exactly why she was on it at, what, 9, 8, 9, and she understands why. She likes yoga. She likes mindfulness. She understands that I don't have to take this every day, right? And when she needs it. Summer camps, we normally don't do it, but one summer camp, she said, Mommy, this summer I want to take my ADHD medicine. I said, why? She said, I want to be patient with myself. I'm going to be doing guitar lessons, some other lessons, and something else, and I know I'll get ramped up, and I want to give myself patience to think and think through it. She understands it. So it's not enough to say, okay, here, take the medicine. Explain why, and explain, like she said, other strategies. So my daughter will run. If you're ADHD, you need at least 30 minutes of extraneous exercise. I got away with it in high school because I ran track, cross country, and indoor track. I was an athlete. So again, it was masked. Didn't know it was there, but my daughter is not a year-round athlete, unfortunately. So she knows she needs to exercise, though. She says, I need to get the thoughts out. I need to get the energy out. So she's understanding how ADHD shows up for her. So it's not enough to just take the medicine. It's not enough to just get the identification, but learn and understand what it means for your child and how it shows up for them.
And one last thing, also get your children blood tested to make sure that their vitamin D and their zinc and the other magnesium and other thing is at the right level, because they found out the children who have ADHD is low. So if you help bring that up where it's supposed to be, you will see a change in your child already.
You know, the other thing this is, I think, just bringing to mind to me, and I do want to pivot and ask a question about parent advocacy, is the challenges within our community about connecting with really good health providers.
Right.
Right. You know, Jerry, I think I heard you say, like, you had this great relationship with your medical professional and could go back and forth. You know, I don't know if we all have that sort of access, right? We don't all have that access. I was thinking not only as far as medical, but also as far as mental health as well. Right? I'm very open about the challenges that I have and have had with depression and anxiety and things along those lines. and, you know, I don't know, a few years back was going through one of the worst times in my life, and ended up just out of a moment of crisis going to county mental health services. And I tell this story all the time that, well, not all the time, but I'll tell it here, is that I remember walking into the intake, and I'm pretty well off. I was going to go to private practice, but I had helped a family member connect to the county services. And so I walked in there, and I was like, I probably won't be here real long. I'm just going through a crisis moment right now. I know y'all. I'm just trying to connect. And there was a 26-year-old white woman who was doing the intake. And I remember looking at her, and I was like, okay, like, if I go forward with this, will you be my therapist? She said, chances are I'm going to be your therapist. I was like, you know, I'm a speaker. I'm kind of like the Michael Jordan in my field, right? You know, like, again, you know, we can talk now, maybe a couple weeks, but I don't know if it's going to work out. And she ended up being my therapist. And that woman, she saved my life. She saved my life. And I mention that because, yes, I could have gone out and sought out a lot of other services, but it ended up that, you know, I got fortunate, I got lucky. It's worth it to us, and I say to everybody, even if you don't think you have issues, go see a therapist one time in your life. Just know that it's available. And then it is a relationship. If you meet someone the first time and you don't click, you know, it's like dating. If y'all don't click, find somebody else. Right? And keep looking and keep searching, right? And until you find someone that works.
And I just want to jump in on that because that's my field.
Okay.
Psychology and dealing with therapy, and especially in the Black community. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's a stigma to go see a therapist or see a psychologist. But I really do believe that it is pivotal, that we need it. And it does help people walk through the process of life, and even children. With my situation I was in, I believe that if I had someone that knew to take me to a therapist at the age that I was when I was going through with my mother and the drugs and all of the lifestyle, I would have been able to channel that energy another direction instead of channeling in the direction that I did, which led me down another path that took me on like what Clarice was saying, her daughter would be here, had these children, had the education and the people to back them. Right. I wouldn't have walked down the path of gangs and violence and drugs and all that myself had I had therapy. And now that's the field that I'm in our community, like I said, it's a stereotype, you know, but it is really needed. And it is high. Mental health is so high in the Black community, but it's covered up by saying, well, this is just the way we are. This is just how I grew up. But no, there are some chemical balances in the mind, and that needs to be dealt with. And so I appreciate the fact that you took yourself, educated me and, you know, who you are, and said, hey, I went and got this help, and it's really needed.
Yeah.
I want to add to that, too. I have a granddaughter who I've been trying to advocate for 3 years to be tested. I know what ADHD looks like. I even know what an inattentive side from my oldest grandson. I knew what the hyper, but I had no idea about the inattentive. I said, oh, he just sits there and just listens. No, that's inattentive ADHD. Okay, I didn't know. I know now. But I said that to say that it's taken 3 years, and now that my granddaughter's in a mental health crisis, because they would not listen 3 years ago. Oh, now they can get her a therapist, and they can do this. But still, the testing for ADHD, they gave us the family, the grand in January. Guess when she's going to get maybe tested? Guess. One guess, one audience participation. September, maybe. October, the possibility.
Wow.
And they know she's in crisis. They know she's in crisis. Please, parents, stay with it, stick with it, stay on them, go to whoever you got to go to get it done. Work with it, and it was something I was supposed to say, but I can't remember it a second. But the importance is also try to support the child. Oh, I know what it was. Thank you, Lord. The school, when I saw her going through it, because, you know, she wasn't turning in her work. You know, she's Miss Chatty Cathy, and you know what they're saying? That she was an AB student, and she got a C, and she was so upset. Then I'm going to put it out there. The black administrator told her, well, that's just a lesson she got to learn. I said, why? I said, I've been coming to you the last 3 weeks telling you about this granddaughter. And how can y'all help me as a school? And y'all say this is something she has to learn? And I'm going to just put it straight. I said, Mary and Becky in the class would not have to learn. You would have helped them through it. I'm just telling you this straight up. So please, press as much as you can.
Just to wrap that up, I want to add in the correlation. When you are not identified, when there's no diagnosis, that anxiety is going to go sky high. I can remember being in third grade, being sent from talented, like in New York, they used to track, right? They tracked us. I'm a little of age, so they tracked us. And so you went from T to E. And I remember not wanting to go in E. And I got in that class in third grade, and their words were a lot longer and harder. And I remember, like, I cannot read that word. Like, oh my gosh, I cannot get that word. That was third grade. So if you are undiagnosed dyslexia, and your ADHD is at capacity where it's really impeding your academics, look at me sound like an educator, right? That third, fourth grade, what do you think is gonna happen? That anxiety, that depression, so now it's more focused on the behavior. Then we get into middle school, and then the hormones and changes, and middle school is hard, period. Right. Because my daughter is 14 and going into high school, since this identification, everything around my career involves learning more about how to help her. Mm-hmm. And what that looks like is now I work part-time at a behavioral health organization because I saw a spike in her anxiety. We talk about high school and where she's gonna go to high school. She's tired of everything being about her dyslexia, and I see her anxiety goes up because now there's this standardized test you have to take for high school. Yeah. So I see young people, young adults, 19 to 31, in that age range, and I can tell when they're neurodivergent. Yeah. And I ask them about their education and what school did they attend and what help did they get, and they didn't get it. And I can tell when they were identified but still didn't get what they need. And I see them struggle. The pandemic added even more. They struggle with their mental health because now the mental health is so bad, there's no time for interventions or anything like that. We can't even give them like practical strategies to read better, you know, to focus, because the depression sits in. And I want to even say that it weighs even heavier, right? So that mental health, when you see a child starting to change, when we look at them, we know that that child we taught in elementary is different than that middle schooler, is different than that high schooler, but when we start to see these changes in mental health, that is a red flag too, because, you know, when you are an adult and then you find out that you're neurodivergent, it's a little emotional right there. When I finally sat with, oh, you are ADHD, and I was like, okay, I got this podcast, I'm an advocate, I talk, it was still very emotional because I said, is that ADHD or is that Winifred? Right. You know, is that Winifred because of ADHD? What if there was no ADHD, right? Like, it's emotional. And I do this work. So we have to look at the mental health of it because it is very much prevalent in the schools when they just come to school to eat, yeah. Right? And there's that depression, but then there's also this undiagnosed learning disability.
Right. So I think maybe we've gone to two of the questions that we wrote down. And actually, I think we've touched on so much of what we wanted to get through. I want to maybe just do a couple of rounds, just sort of targeting certain populations. So we've talked a lot here about family as well as education. Maybe we can just go down the line. Advice to educators, right? If you've got a young person in your class or in your school who has a learning disability, challenges with reading, what's maybe one or two pieces of advice everyone can give to the educators who are out here listening?
I would definitely have to say just listen and be patient, because the ears that you have need to be used, and you don't need to always have a solution towards things. Sometimes people just need to be heard, and then the solution's after. Mm. So that's the main thing that I feel like really was the biggest for me, just being able to sit, talk, and then find a solution after I was able to really sit and with my thoughts and feelings.
I would say don't just push a child to the side because it seems like they don't want to learn. Take the time to sit down with that child to get to really understand where that child is coming from and know the background of why this child doesn't want to learn what you're trying to present to them. And then also, once you find out, go a little deeper. Go into the family. Connect with the parents, you know, in the Black community. We're not scary people. Let me just say that we're not. The hood is not a scary place to go to. I grew up in the hood, okay? So take the time to get to know us, and then you'll know how to deal with that child even on another personal level.
I would say to educators, watch your words. All of us on this stage can tell you what teacher said what to us when. And I'm over the 60, and I know somebody else might be over the 50. And you still know that? Watch your words. They don't sting, they cut, they stab. You break the child. They don't want to learn. The other thing that I would want to tell educators is, especially a person who has dyslexia or ADHD, they're giving you 500%.
That's right.
They're giving it to you. But you keep saying the same thing the same way, and their brain is like, what? What? And then maybe after the 50th time, you're like, oh. I need you to recognize that when I'm trying to teach somebody something, I've said it twice and they still don't get it. Me as an educator, me as the one with the degree, oh, I'm going to have to differentiate, you know that word I'm trying to say. My learning, my teaching. Change out what you're saying. And we can do it.
Yeah. There's a... You're trying to say differentiate, right? I just want to make sure. Because I had three possibilities in my mind when you said that. I'm like... All appropriate. No, nothing inappropriate. All appropriate. But I had three variations that I was branching from, and I just there's a couple things that I want to be able to say as far as speaking to educators. Okay, understand resiliency versus value. Now I thought the name fails me, and I really wanted to put her out there. She gave a keynote at the Nonprofit Association of the Midlands Summit last year. And she talked about specifically speaking to like women of color, but we're talking about Black and brown kids that are impacted by this. My little Black Diamonds of Pearls, I always make that Nas reference, if you know, that song, but whatever, okay. When something is resilient, you'll use it, but you won't have a regard to how the upkeep is towards it. So think about like a work truck. Right? You're going to want to be able to get everything out of it. You're going to say, yeah, it's great. Yeah, you fit. Yeah, you belong because I need you to do this. I need you to do that. But you don't have as much regard toward, you know, how well it's preserved. You know it has value, but it doesn't have as much inherent value as the 67 Mustang Cobra that's sitting in your garage. That you'll make sure you pour over all the ingredients of the waxes and polishes at the store before you buy them. You're going to make sure that nobody puts their fingerprints on it after you've polished it. You're going to take it out to car shows. You're not going to let it get rained on because you understand its value. It could also produce when it needs to because it has a lot of horsepower, but you're leading with preserving its value. So with these kids, let's not look at them as far as being resilient or being rugged. And this might almost seem counterintuitive to when people initially see my approach because I'm always about sky-high expectations. But I always lead with it because I expect this from you because I see how much value you actually have. Yeah. You're telling me you can top out at 55 miles an hour. I'm telling you that's a bold-faced lie. Mm-hmm. You just have to find a way. You haven't shifted into gear yet or something. We got to figure this out. But you have an incredible amount of value, and I want people to be able to see that in you. If you're the one that needs to be able to help them, show them how they got to polish that car or how to tune it up or whatever it is to be able to show the rest of the world the value that they have, then make sure that you do that. And, you know, with encouragement, I'm really big on encouragement. I love to encourage the kids, but I think there's kind of a misnomer when it comes to encouraging people. Courage, the byproduct of encouraging someone is not happiness. You don't need courage to walk into a situation where you're going to be happy and giddy. You need courage to be able to endure hardship.
Right.
So
right.
If I'm encouraging them and they're going, but I thought you were going to, you know, this, it's like they misunderstand encouragement, but this doesn't feel good. This sucks. This is going to take forever. Well, champ, you know, I'm trying to get you ready for new levels, right? So that way when you're looking back, you can say, you know what, you gave me what I needed. I see my own value. I might not have liked it right away, but I'm glad you did what you did.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't need to see the beginning from the end. I get to only paint one part of the house, but I don't need to see the finished product yet. Come back in 20 years and show me how good of a finished product you are.
Yeah. Thank you. We talked a lot about education and in the school system, but I got most of my training in this space from grassroots organizations, from parents of children who have dyslexia, ADHD, who were struggling readers. So I want to ask, how can grassroots initiatives and community-based organizations address the unique needs of individuals with learning disabilities from diverse backgrounds? You know, we always hear, how do I reach the Black people? Like, we're right here. Like, we're right here. We're in your face. So I also know that these grassroots organizations are powerful. They have created change. In the state of Maryland, we fought grassroots organization, so now that every child in kindergarten will be screened for reading failure. Grassroots, parent-driven organization did that. I sit on a board with the state of Maryland, a special education board, and I told them bluntly in a little private session, now we're on live, dang it. I said, when we hear that someone will come in and they'll say, oh, I'm an educator, I've been a special educator for 25 years. I said, as a parent, we chuckle. I probably know more than you, mm-hmm. Right? So how can we make that connection and maybe help communities come together to really focus on those who are left behind? Like, how do we employ grassroots organizations? How do we tap into that pool to then help educators, right? Because it takes a village, it takes a community. And I know firsthand it was grassroots organizations that helped me. I went to a lunch and learn with a disability rights. An attorney was talking. I didn't understand anything. I didn't really know much about the 8 or 9 steps in the IEP process. And someone said, you asked really great questions. Have you heard of this organization? And then once I went to that organization, that's when everything changed. I learned about private schools. I learned about structured literacy, the science of reading, COPA. I always say it wrong. Is that right? Yeah. So I learned about all these different organizations through grassroots organizations in the community. But what we didn't have were Black parents. I often was the only Black parent. And I'm like, okay, there are more parents out here that want to know, that want to give of their time. That's a misconception that we don't show up, right? That we don't show up, and that is not true. And so how can we, and what do you think we can do to employ that connection in this space? Because a lot of us are here. How many are here that are part of a grassroots organization? Look at that, right? Right? So we know that it works.
Okay, I'm gonna start off with, like I said, I'm the co-founder of Decoded Dyslexia DC, and not only do we get a law passed, 23-191, is for kindergarten through second grade screening, but all educators in the city, whether they public or charter, have to do a video about dyslexia and they have to pass the test. So that's citywide, but as an organization too, that we have to go where the people are. We have to go to those football games, because those football games, I'm just being straight up, 30 years of doing this, those parents are at the football game, they're at the basketball game. They're at the soccer games. They're out wherever the children are, that's where the parents are. So we have to make it so that we can do have that little sheet that's going to, you know, that they can look at it quick and then pull them in like that. Because once we give the parents the knowledge, when they come into those schools, then they are looked at differently. Because I'm just straight up, when you're coming in now, they look like they don't know anything, I can say anything, and the IEP meeting's over, or you're not gonna be tested, all this stuff. So go where the parents are. Mm-hmm. And the mayor used to say, well, I was an ANC commissioner, which is the third level of district government. You represent Ward 7. What you doing over here in Ward 2? I said, this the city, isn't it? When I go to the council and speak, they're talking about road construction. Guess what I'm talking about? Reading, teachers. And they go like, Commissioner Carson Carr, this thing is about, I said, don't I have 2 minutes to talk about whatever I want to talk about?
Right.
So, but it's spreading the word, because guess what? People are looking at that hearing about the road construction or whatever, but now they're learning something new because I was there. Be brave, go out, and just spread the word.
Now, I was just going to agree with her saying actually going to the people. You have to go to them to reach them. And just on a note, you know, you say reach one, teach one. You know, I think if we go to the parents door to door and then have programs like this that's open to the community where, you know, we can go to a park and have food and just have fun, but at the same time we're educating them on this information. You know, putting on programs like that in the hood where it's needed and saying, hey, we're here. We have these programs. We have these grassroots programs for you in the community that you can bring your child to that can help. I think really going to the parents is going to help.
I mean, not being an adult, I don't have much to say about the topic, but I feel like this really does kind of connect to my CSI that I have with doing pageants, and it's called Made for More, mm-hmm. Overcome and Inspire. And for me personally, I go to the kids because mm-hmm. it's me being able to teach them about not being afraid to speak up for themselves and advocate for themselves. And not only do that, but then continue to take what I teach them and teach it to others. I went to a school in North Omaha a couple weeks ago, and I shared a lot of STEM stuff with them because it was a STEM class of all girls. And it was really amazing for me to be able to really have girls who look like me look up to me and call me a princess and really make me feel like I belonged. And also made me feel like I was really teaching them things. And having them want me to come back and teach them more is the best thing that I could ever have gotten from that, because it means that I've impacted them and done something for them and made them feel confident in themselves. And being able to take that from my mom, who's giving me such a great opportunity in all of my schools and who has advocated for me the best that she possibly can, hearing from a mom at that school say that she was so proud of the way that my mom has raised me is the best thing from my mom and from me. Yeah.
I think that was a great response. You tied that in really well. Let me talk about, so you used the phrasing grassroots organizations. So grassroots organizations, nonprofit entities. I want to just kind of talk about them in the Black community. Our churches are still extremely powerful.
Yes. Yes.
Right? The Black church has always been a source of resources mm-hmm. for us. Now, I tend to do work more broadly, like in the disability world, sort of disability broadly. But one of the things that I always say is that all of our churches need to have a disability ministry.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so, you know, whether it be dyslexia or other challenges, there should be a safe space for our families to go and to get resources and connect to broader resources throughout their community. I mean, leverage the strength and the infrastructure that we have. You know, one of, you know, as I crisscross the U.S., everybody knows Claire Reese, and a big part of that is the work that she's done with the NAACP,
right.
With recognizing dyslexia as a part of their platform. You know, so a lot of our organizations that are strong, do work solidly in the Black community, are not looking at neurodiversity as an issue.
Right.
They're not looking at that this is a natural part of what it is to be a human being. And we think about it sometimes like challenges when it comes to like our seniors or what have you, but not oftentimes when it comes to literacy, and particularly for those of us who are neurodivergent or born with challenges where we need things sort of presented to us in a quote-unquote different way. The other thing is that kind of innate in the way you were phrasing that, and you were very political with the way you were dropping that, Winifred, is these are white-run nonprofits and grassroots organizations that get all of their stuff together and then say, okay, who are the Black folks we can invite?
Yeah.
Right? And it's very much like Dr. Washington was talking about as it pertains to assessments. Don't figure the whole thing out and then come and talk to us.
Right?
So this is important because the diversity on boards matter. Right? And it's not just having that one or two token people of color, right? But it's having us being an integral part of how organizations are built out from the beginning. If you want to succeed, I'm talking to white folks, you want to succeed, like that has to be at the very beginning. The other piece of it is who you employ.
Right.
Right? And I've had side conversations with some of the advocates in this space, you know, like when it comes time to get consultants and the attorneys and even the folks who print your programs, look to Black folks, look to people of color. If you don't have like, you know, your neighbor ain't Black, you know, okay, you know, put some money in some Black people's pockets. We can start building community that way, right? I think there's these issues around the way that some of these grassroots organizations are sort of structured from the beginning, why they have challenges connecting with us is because they're not having us and our voices in the beginning.
Yeah.
We should go to Q&A. We got a few minutes. And I got the feeling that maybe this Q&A is going to go like really, really well. So I want to give them some time. So why don't we do the Q&A and then we'll do one last question to everybody from everybody just to kind of help close this out.
Is that all right?
All right. I want to be the mic runner. Okay? Because I've been sitting still for too long. All right? No, I got it. So, okay, Dr. Washington, her hand went right up. Literally the runner. You see this?
Thank you, Derek. So one of the things that I didn't hear anybody say until the last gentleman in the white shirt is I'm really struck by how old people are before they're being diagnosed.
Yes.
There is no early diagnosis happening here. So I didn't hear anybody say anything about expectations. Do you think that some of the late diagnosis reflects low expectations for you? And it's not just about the intellectual things that you've come up with, because you kind of intellectualized it, but I wonder about that.
So we ran out of time, but that was next on my docket. There was a study that was done in concert with a researcher from UC Berkeley and a researcher from UNC, University of North Carolina, and they found out that when young Black male students are paired with Black teachers, there is a material difference in the amount of diagnosis of special education. And I reposted on my LinkedIn and said I curtly refer to this as a no-duh moment, because we understand very well in the African-American community how much of a rift there is culturally, right? If you haven't read the book or, you know, even tried to peruse it, there's a book called Why Do All the Black Kids Sit Together at the Lunch Table? Or something along that. I'm about 92% accurate on that title, so just look that up. But, you know, and I see that in my own school community. Well, there it's not because there's an aversion or there's any kind of quote-unquote racist ideology behind it. It's cultural in its foundation. It's because they don't have to explain themselves to one another. And they are infused in a system that was built beforehand and that they were integrated into afterwards, right? Because remember, education was integrated. It wasn't constructed. It was integrated. When you integrate something, it's not native to that environment. So I really do think that there is a low expectation for black and brown kids. I do. I think some of it might be as a result of implicit bias. I think some of it might just be being ignorant of what to actually look for. And I can't say that every non-black or non-brown educator is just sitting here, got some sort of secret agenda in the back of their head going, I'm just going to keep them down, you know. I don't think that's happening. But I do also think that your nurturing your nature can play into how much you will expect from those kids that don't look like you. It will. It will absolutely play a role. So, yes, I really do think that there is generally low expectations. I think the answer for that is going to be manifold in nature. But that's something that, again, that's why I hold high expectations, that phrase near and dear to my heart, that I'm always looking for. Am I selling them short by not doing this or not doing that or not expecting this or not expecting that?
Implicit biasness is there. My two grandsons were diagnosed in second and third grade. The third grade teacher told my grandson, who's now 20, you can't use that computer because you won't have a computer all your life. Okay. Yes. Oh, quote, okay. So even though when you get the child diagnosed early, you're still fighting with the administrators and the teachers about it. So, and then the part that we talked about when we were older learning, we still hurt and still trying to recover from what we missed back then that we would never get.
That's true. I'm just sitting here thinking, when you said that, it made me think about it. I mentioned this to Dr. Washington, what my teacher said to me. She told me that I wasn't going to make it. I wasn't going to be anything. And I was in junior high school. And that stuck with me for years, that you're not going to make it. You're not going to be anything. And so I already had the issue of the couldn't read and understand. And then I have that from a black teacher, let me go put that out there, to tell me that I wouldn't make it and I wasn't going to be anything. And so it became a major challenge, you know. So I think just from the beginning, my God, just being able to be concerned with the children when you see there's a problem, don't turn just a face and say, oh, that's just a problem child. Really dig in and find out why. Really find out why. If that teacher had took the time to see, well, what's going on with this young lady? Why is she acting up in my class? And said, let me sit you down as a black teacher and say, you know what? Let me mentor you and show you another way. And I know you have difficulties in this area, but let me help you. Would have helped me in a whole nother perspective of life. It would have took me down a different path. So that's just my point on that. I think if we just focus in and see, hey, this child needs a little bit more attention, and don't push them aside.
Okay, so why do we think that we've started as a black people, the NAACP, we started the civil rights issues. Why do we think this education issue is such a struggle for us to make inroads in?
Go ahead, I'm gonna let you go.
Okay. You know how you're supposed to be politically correct? Yeah, but they know me, okay? Let's talk about that elephant in the room. They want to keep their privilege. They would kill their own mothers if you taught an enslaved person to read, because reading brought knowledge. Knowledge brought
power.
Say it together.
Power.
Power. Straight up. I don't even have to talk long. That's it.
So why is it that we've had these organizations around so long and we haven't really seemed like we've gotten a... We haven't come in solidarity to really address this huge issue of education. I think it's because we've been in survival mode with education for so long. And it really is a monolith in a lot of ways because of how it's been structured throughout this country. You're going to get just about the same thing in every state and every community that you go to. That can be kind of intimidating to take on. And it's a lot of work. And it's something that you have to really think generationally about. So you have to, there's going to be some patience that's going to be involved with that. And that's what, personally, from my own pursuit, that's what I'm kind of in for the long haul. Like, if I can create proof of concept in some small way, then that can be replicated, right? That's kind of, you know, that's how we have all sorts of innovation and stuff in this country. And we got, you know, NASA-sized computers in our pocket because somebody provided a proof of concept that this could work. Now we got to refine it.
So I have a two-part question. The first part is, I am here as an educator as well as an advocate. And I will say, working in an, let me specify, a public educator. Because I feel as though that private schools, especially private schools that specialize in learning differences, kind of have a bit of a different edge, if you will, right? Because that is what you're doing. As a public educator, it's a little different. And it feels too often like we're trying to navigate two systems, especially in knowing what is available, knowing what you can do, but also trying to walk that fine line. There are things that we can't say. There are ways that we can't necessarily help. And so I would ask, I guess my first question is, what do you say to educators that are literally stuck in the middle and trying to navigate both worlds? And then my second question is, one of the things that I thought in starting to study dyslexia was that it was a Black community thing, like American Black community thing. I thought it was kind of like a post-traumatic slave syndrome thing, as to why we didn't, you know, want to get our children identified and things of that nature. But now I'm in a setting where I work with a lot of kids who are immigrants, specifically from African countries and South America, and I'm learning that it's literally a Black thing. And so, like, you know, it's hard to talk to those particular parents as well about having their child identified. Have you guys ran into that, and how would you navigate that particular space?
Yeah, I think a lot of it's about education. So first question, you're talking about being a public educator and having to kind of straddle that line. Like, how do you do that? Early in my career, when I was still working in brokerage finance, I remember our chief of brokerage operations, I'd won a quarterly award. And it was like right before they started giving out really good awards. That's why I remember this, because I got this sucky little thing. And then they started giving out TVs the very next quarter. I was like... and he came over, he shook my hand and stuff. The guy was a Marine, you know, had worked, he was extremely hard worker, high expectations for himself. I just loved the work that he did and his approach towards everything. And he said, you know, if you continue to work hard and then you worry about what you can control, he said, you will do very well for yourself. He says, you know, just keep it up and all that kind of rah-rah stuff later on. But the biggest thing about worrying about what you can control, right? We have to be able to look at this as far as what's within my span of control and what can I do about it. Sometimes we go from zero to 100 in our minds as far as, you know, we just blow that scale out. And it's like you're going from like pano to like, you know, 12x zoom. You know, that's kind of the difference. And I'm going, you know, just have faith in what you're doing every day that it's going to be able to make incremental gains and it's going to be able to move that needle. Because to kind of compliment that is that someone's always watching your life. I remember I had another friend of mine, he had said that. Someone's always watching your life. So someone's watching what you're doing. They're going to want to replicate that. They're going to see the success that you're having. They're going to see you moving the needle. They're going to want to move that needle too. Okay? But it's going to take consistency. Anything that we're going to try to do that's going to have to be that we're playing that long game, this is chess. It's not checkers. Absolutely not checkers. We're going to be able to see the change that we need to see.
So as a former public educator, I worked as an administrator first, and then I went back to be a high school teacher. And what I can tell you is I understand when you say there's certain things you can't say, right? But with knowledge, there is power. I would refer parents to resources. So with Decode and Dyslexia, there is an educator group. It's not public. I understand that if some of those teachers speak up, they can, in fact, lose their job. They can, in fact, be reprimanded. I worked in HR. So a part of my job was to get rid of teachers, right? And they do check social media, right? But if you educate yourself where you can point that parent, there are free resources. I know in the state of Maryland, there's a free resource for parents of children who receive special education services. I know her firsthand. Right? I know her. She knows me. My nonprofit, we help parents access quality, affordable remediation. So we're helping them pay for tutoring. We're helping them pay for an advocate or connecting them to an advocate. And we're helping pay for the evaluations. She'll call me. I can't tell her to come to you, but is it okay if I give her your number? Like, we move in silence, but we're connected, right? So I send her to that free resource. That free resource knows me, right? And she understands, like, okay, this parent, I can't say it to her, but Winifred can have that conversation. So you build a network. And that was another idea for the platform, for the podcast. We've had literacy experts on the podcast. I have educators that say, I can't go on. I'm afraid to, okay? So as a public school educator, network and build a community, build resources and funnel them the way you can, right? I had a student who was taking Spanish and we didn't have a person, online Spanish, and we didn't have a person in the building who spoke Spanish. Exactly, exactly. Exactly. So I slid some information to the aunt, and next thing you know, she was like, Miss Winston, I'm in your class. You're going to help me catch up. I don't have to take Spanish anymore. But I knew if I would have outright told that parent, and sometimes, like, you have to be careful, right? Because you know sometimes that parent will unknowingly say, she said, he said, and then you get in trouble, right? So if you educate yourself, what resources are out there and what relationships can you build? I get people that call me all the time. You know, they say, Winifred, I had a conversation. I couldn't get through to them. I can't say this, but you can, mm-hmm. right? So build your network of resources and education. Now, as far as cultural differences, we've had someone on the podcast from the UK. We talk about it, and we've got a partner in Africa. Where's LaDerek at? So we know.
Nancy in Kenya.
It's out there. It's out there, but it's a cultural difference. And what do we do with that? We educate. Right? So I have a lot of Hispanic parents reaching out now because we know that they'll just dump them in Esau, right? And we know that that's not it. And I'll have the Hispanic parents saying to me, it's more, it's more. And now what am I doing? I'm educating them about what dyslexia is and what it is not, right? So it is about education. So you can find us, Black and Dyslexic Podcast, and I can share resources because I find a lot of great resources from other countries, and we have resources in the show notes, but it is not a Black thing. Our UK person, Marcia, she thought it was the white side of her. She thought it was a white thing, and she thought it was the white side of her, or how she get white in her because she had dyslexia. So it's just about education, and it's a cultural thing. Dyslexia does not discriminate. It does not discriminate. And so you have to educate those parents and come from a place that they will understand it. If it's somebody in their country that they know or some person that they say, oh, that person has dyslexia and they're doing X, Y, Z, but it's all about education. But it is not just a Black thing. It does not discriminate. But again, it is about education.
If I could just add from the back of the room, I think another piece of this is linguistic access. You know, like, so particularly when you know, the African diaspora is very broad. Not everyone is English speakers. I mean, even all the information we're sharing right now, it's all in English, right? So for, you know, my Haitian brothers and sisters or, you know, folks from South America who may speak Portuguese or Spanish or what have you, right? Like, they may not be able to get the same degree of access to the information we're sharing now. So this is particularly to educators and advocates. Linguistic access is part of the way in which we broaden this conversation and bring in more people, right? You found me, so you get to ask the next question.
Yes, I did. So, two-pronged question. One, the business community does not realize we have a literacy crisis in this country. And a bold vision that instead of incarcerating and having a new Jim Crow, that we educate, like I keep hearing over and over again, so that we can be the most literate country in the world. How do we engage the business community in this conversation so they realize we can do so much better? That's the first half. The second question is, what would happen if our HBCUs were preparing the most equipped diagnostic and prescriptive teachers in the country? When Clarice does this next time, deans all over this country need to be in this room.
Okay, thank you for that one.
All right, let me, because this is my jam right here. Then I'll let y'all go.
All right, just before you go in, we got 10 minutes.
Oh, okay. You sure? All right.
I'm sure.
Okay, so having a background in HR and working in education, I also worked in corporate first. So a part of my nonprofit was workplace solutions, right? because I'm like, okay, I know how to go in under soft skills training, not on the back end, right, but soft skills training, how to educate businesses. And because of my HR and career services, how to tie that to employment. There was a study, illiteracy was costing businesses $1.3 billion. Show them the money. We got to talk money. We got to show them the money, how illiteracy is impacting the business. Now, when you say HBCUs, Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland, that's where I live. Through my partnerships, Morgan State University is the only HBCU in the state of Maryland that is revamping their teacher prep program to align. Okay, that's Dr. Gibson. Simone Gibson, because we're on live, I'm putting her name out there. She is doing that work. My goal was to tap every HBCU in Maryland and also North Carolina, where I went to school, but it is not easy, okay? Higher ed and the academic side, I was on student affairs. We need a collective to tackle that, right? My grandmother was an educator. We need to get back to that. My mother went to an all-black school. You can't tell me she wasn't educated better than me. I know she was, because we had to. And so that is my vision, and I've been trying to work with IDA because they have the accreditation for undergraduate programs. Because initially, when I started this journey, that's exactly where I wanted to tap into, because that's where my strength was, because I worked in higher ed. But that is on my radar. That's what I want to do. We're going to connect, because every HBCU should be educating our teachers on how to teach reading. But this is what I will say, having an HR background. When businesses go to recruit, and even when districts make the decision to recruit, they're looking at the numbers. Do I go to the predominantly white school that's doing whole language, right? Do I go there where there's 200 candidates, or do I pay to go to this HBCU where I might have 25? So they're looking at the numbers, right? It's a numbers game when you plan your targeted efforts to do recruitment, right? It's a numbers game. So they are looking at that. But then also, I employ the school districts, right? The superintendent out of Philly, he told higher ed, we will be a pipeline for your school if you guys are teaching your teachers how to teach reading. He made a bold move. He said that. We need more districts to say that so that higher ed can do what they need to do.
Okay, so I would like everyone to go down. Start with you, Jerry, and we'll come this way. One last piece of advice. You decide who you wanted to be to. You know, black kids with dyslexia, if you want to go to parents, schools, policymakers, whoever. But one piece of advice, and just let us know who it's going to go to. Before we start that, though, part of my job is to support Winifred, all right? So the Black and Dyslexic Podcast is an initiative out of Dyslexia Advocation, which is her nonprofit organization. We got people in this room, we got people on live, there's gonna be people who listen to the podcast. If they wanna donate, if they wanna support your organization, what do they have to do?
Donate at soallcanread.org. Our website is soallcanread.org. Again, I'm doing something that not many folks are doing. We're helping pay for the tutoring, the evaluations, and the advocates and attorneys, right? We know this journey costs money. Mm-hmm. It costs money. I say this all the time. In a matter of 3 days, I was told I needed more than $30,000 in order to help my daughter read. That was for an expensive tutoring program, and then that was the evaluation. And I didn't have $30,000 in 3 days. And I thought, oh my gosh, how am I going to help my daughter learn to read? We ended up paying for tutoring. 1 week I would pay, 1 week I would swipe my credit card, the next week her dad would pay, then he would swipe his credit card, then the next, like, we literally had a campaign. That's what we were doing. And I had to pay a driver, because we both worked, to pick her up from school to take her to the tutoring. So it costs money. Even if it's $250 for a parent just to sit with an advocate who understands and can point them in the right direction, right? Or it's me talking them out of an evaluation, because they've already had the evaluation done by the school, but they don't understand what that evaluation means. So it's very important that we do get donations to continue to move this work, to continue to produce this podcast so we can educate, equip, and empower the masses. So you would go to www.soallcanread.org to donate.
All right, last piece of advice. I would say that this is not an all-encompassing solution here, right? We didn't sit up here and solve all the world's problems. What we did is I feel like this conversation, I hope what you glean from it is that there is a problem to be solved and that you can play a pivotal role in that. I would also say that, not to give up. For educators, use your creativity. Be creative with things. My boss all the time tells me I come up with cockamamie ideas. And I'm like, well, I'm going to keep coming up with cockamamie ideas because somehow we're going to flesh something useful out of that. So, just keep coming up with ideas and just be bold and be creative. And, like I said, bring your heart into it with the goal of seeing these kids through the eyes of how valuable they are.
Okay. We're not going to wait any longer. We've waited already. Brown versus the Board of Education is giving it to be 70 years. 70 years! We've waited! We've been those good African Americans. Waiting. No. Wait time is over. Demand what you want. Okay? And get it. Okay? And also, that dyslexia does not come by itself, it doesn't like being by itself. So it always brings one or two, ADHD, executive function, slow processing speed. all of these things. Oh, dysgraphia, dyscalculia.
Mental health.
Well, I'm getting there. Mental health. So all of these things could be your child. It could be you. So. Okay, that you can have patience with yourself. But understand what you're seeing from your child and address each of those issues. And lastly, all of us up here are always watching something. We're always trying to learn things. And one of the podcasts I saw about Women Pelosi, this lady, can you hold this?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
I got
this lady was, the doctor was on there talking, and she was talking about dyslexia. And you know how we teach the kids to air write? She said, depending on whichever hand you use, you're only touching one part of your frontal lobe. Cuff the hands and write with both hands. So you are now using both sides of your brain, and it gets to sink in longer and faster. And she also said that our children takes 300 times or more before they really get it. So repeat it. Remember, hand over hand, air writing, both sides.
Just be patient and have compassion for these kids, for real. Like I said, don't push them aside. Just have the patience and compassion to really dig deep and see where they're coming from. That would be my last final words.
Mine is out to everyone who has dyslexia or a child who has dyslexia. They are always made for more, and that's why I chose those words. Made for more. You can do more than anybody has ever told you if you just put your mind to it. You can push yourself to be the best version of yourself that you can be, and that is the greatest thing to strive for and to get yourself out of the mindset of doubt and just bad moods and bad vibes. It is so important to be in the right mindset with your child and with yourself. Being able to listen to yourself and your body and what it's telling you is the biggest thing possible. If you need help, voice that and get that out there, because no one can do anything for you besides yourself. You need to be able to be the one who wants to learn and move on and be the bigger person.
We are the Black and Dyslexic Podcast, live from Black Literacy Matters. Thank you so much. Can we please give a round of applause?
Well, they got a standing ovation. I think you guys liked it, right?
Tune in next week where we'll continue to bring you lived experiences and more unfiltered conversations with experts in the field around all things Black and dyslexic. Make sure you subscribe and follow the Black and Dyslexic podcast, where we educate, empower, and equip Black and underrepresented minorities. The Black and Dyslexic podcast is partially funded by Morgan Cares and the Center for Urban Health Disparities Research and Innovation, awarded by the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. The Black and Dyslexic podcast is sponsored by Dyslexia Advocation Incorporated, a 501c3 charitable organization located in Baltimore City, Maryland, whose mission is to equip parents of children with dyslexia and other language-based learning disabilities with the necessary tools to help their children become successful readers. You can find them on the web at www.soallcanread.org.